This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Latin American Update. We analyze the latest developments regarding the political crisis in Venezuela, and we examine U.S.-Brazilian relations. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. We go first to Venezuela, where President and strongman Nicolas Maduro has pulled almost every lever at his disposal to retain his grip on power in the country. His administration has blocked the flow of humanitarian aid, which may bolster his opposition, led by the head of the Venezuelan National Assembly, Juan Guaido. Still in control of the military, Maduro has recently detained Guaido's top assistant, a daring move to keep the resistance in check. Maduro has also reportedly received military aid from Russia, one of his few remaining international allies. The recent unrest was triggered by Maduro's assumption of a new six-year term in early January on the basis of an election condemned internationally as fraudulent. Over 50 countries worldwide, including the United States, have officially recognized Juan Guaido as the legitimate interim leader of Venezuela. With widespread power outages, frequent civilian demonstrations, a nearly collapsed economy, and heavy sanctions from the United States, the country is facing dire straits in the weeks and months ahead. Also up for discussion is Brazil, whose newly elected president, Jair Bolsonaro, recently visited the White House. Nicknamed Trump of the Tropics, Bolsonaro, a retired military officer, shares similarly right-wing views as U.S. President Donald Trump and echoes his provocative populist anti-immigrant positions. Bolsonaro has also emerged as an ally with President Trump on the issue of Venezuela, pre-placing humanitarian aid that Washington has sent to the Brazilian-Venezuelan border. Well, with me to discuss these topics are two distinguished regional analysts. Eric Farnsworth, who is no stranger to these VOA microphones, is vice president of the Council of the Americas and the America Society. That's a leading voice on Western Hemisphere affairs. And Kristen Tennyson, she's the chair of the Western Hemisphere Area Studies Division at the Foreign Service Institute, the foreign affairs training provider for employees of the U.S. State Department. And both guests join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Carol. It's good to be back.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. Well, let me begin with you, Eric, here at the microphones, a veteran. Let's look at Venezuela. What's your take on the latest turn of events in that country? We witnessed another severe power outage affecting most of the country, and now news reports saying that two Russian Air Force planes carrying a Russian defense official and nearly 100 troops have arrived in Caracas.
Venezuela is a country in full-scale collapse, it seems to me. The power grid is completely decrepit and failing by the day. Food supplies are scarce for many people. Health supplies are simply unavailable for many people, to the point where fully one-tenth of the entire population has left, either as refugees or trying to migrate somewhere else. This is a country that cannot provide for its own citizens. There are estimates that as many as 5 million Venezuelans will have left the country by the end of this year, or even more. So it's probably, unfortunately, going to get worse before it gets better. And the reason why is because the government of Nicolas Maduro remains in power, and they are the cause of the collapse of the country through their economic policies, through their security policies, and through their increasingly anti-democratic behavior. So this is a country that is in desperate need of international humanitarian assistance.
Well, turning to you, Kristen Tennyson, even if Eric is blaming, of course, the crisis on Nicolas Maduro, of course, Nicolas Maduro is blaming the United States, which, of course, is pretty implausible. Nonetheless, this is the rhetoric. This is the propaganda. Somehow the United States is trying to orchestrate a coup. What's your take on the latest turn of events?
So let me first say that I'm here as a regional scholar and that my views are not necessarily representative of the U.S. government or those of the Department of State. That being said, there is sort of this wonder at the ability of the Maduro administration to retain any public or popular support. And yet, consistently in public opinion polls that are available, there is a very strong 20% of the population that still sort of buys the administrative line. And thinking sort of cynically about these rolling power outs and thinking about the access to information from the outside of Venezuela and that causes with a lack of internet access, it really does allow the administration to sort of block information from the outside so that they can maintain this idea and this assumption that this is somehow an assault from the outside of their country and not something that is the cause of internal falling asleep at the wheel on some of the major infrastructures in the country. So that definitely lends credibility and credence. And yet these narratives that the United States is sort of behind a coup, it resonates really well with a segment of the population that has a long historic memory of interventions over the years, particularly, you know, the 1980s and 90s in Central America. That resonates. But the reality is that it's a trope that is used very effectively in times of political strife to sort of blame the outsider. But this is really the failing of the Maduro government.
Turning back to you, Eric Farnsworth. Just last week, Fabiana Rosales, the wife of opposition leader and self-declared interim president Juan Guaido, met with President Trump. President Trump condemned the arrival of Russian troops and again reiterated that, quote, all options are on the table when asked if the United States would be willing to put boots on the ground to counter the Russians and to oust Maduro. How serious do you think is Washington about this option? And are you concerned about the arrival of Russian troops, notwithstanding a low number? What does this portend?
Well, in terms of the use of force, I think it's a statement of fact to say that all options are on the table. That's just a statement of statecraft, but it doesn't mean that all options are appropriate in the current circumstances or that anything such as that is imminent. And so I think that's simply something to put on notice to the regime in Caracas that the United States is very serious about seeing this forward toward the restoration of democracy in Venezuela. In terms of the Russian situation, if the Russians wanted to have arrived secretly, they would have not have come in on Russian-marked planes at Maiquetia, the main airport of Caracas. They would have come in covertly. So there's some question about what is their actual purpose there. Is it to send a signal? Is it to upgrade or to maintain equipment that Russia sold to the Chavez regime? Or is it to establish a presence of warfighting troops on the ground? I think the latter is probably not the case in the current circumstances, but that's not to say that Russia doesn't have a very fluid relationship with the Maduro regime. They provide political support at the international level, certainly at the United Nations, certainly bilaterally. There are investments in the energy sector. There are supplies of military equipment and advisors. So this is something that not just the United States, but now also the Lima group of Latin American countries and Canada have condemned as being unhelpful for political transition in Venezuela and indeed for democracy in the Western Hemisphere. Carol, let me make one other point in the context of Juan Guaido and why it's so important that we understand what's really going on here. He is the interim president by virtue of Venezuela's constitution, which says that if there is no president in place, that the head of the national legislature becomes the interim president for the purpose of organizing elections. And the reason why there has been no president in place is, as you accurately said, the international community did not recognize the re-election of Nicolas Maduro because it was a completely fraudulent exercise. So having said that, Guaido, as the head of the national legislature, becomes the interim president. So when we hear that he was self-proclaimed, I think that gives the wrong impression. It really is, this is a constitutional standing. And the constitution, in fact, was put in place by Hugo Chavez, the father of the Bolivarian Revolution. So something that the opposition saw as a constitutional activity. And as soon as this occurred, then the United States and many other countries, as you said, came in alongside and recognized Juan Guaido as the legitimate interim president.
Well, thank you for reminding us of that. So back to you, Kristen Tennyson. How worried are you about Russian involvement and other nefarious actors? Remind us who else is backing the Maduro government still.
So from reporting that I've read, the overall number of Russian personnel on the ground hasn't shifted dramatically. And much to Eric's point, if they'd wanted to come in secrecy to aid the Maduro government, they very easily could have done that. This was really symbolic in showing that they still very strongly back the Maduro government and are continuing to provide military aid and assistance. So it's symbolic more than anything, but also is troublesome because in an attempt to try to have some sort of peaceful transition and resumption of democracy and get aid to the Venezuelan people, this is something that definitely throws sand in the process or a wrench in the works, depending on how you view it. But we also have concerns, you know, about China's economic interest in Venezuela as well. I mean, they have invested billions into the country, and they don't want to see a loss of investment there, and they want to ensure that whatever government comes into place honors the investments that they've made. That's clearly a concern they might have. And then also, Cuba continues to lend support to the Maduro regime and has deep ideological similarities. And so they're not the only interested party. Russia's not the only one.
Two quick questions before we turn to a break. Back to you, Eric Farnsworth. There are two constituencies that are key, perhaps, for some kind of a transition, and that is that the poor, who have been Maduro's traditional base of support, do you see any signs that they are turning on him, as well as the military, because they are really critical commanders? Are we seeing signs that they would abandon Maduro?
The short answer is yes, but. And the but is not in sufficient quantities at this point, particularly on the military and security side, to force a change from Mr. Maduro. To the first question, I totally agree with Kristen. There is a solid 20% or so basis of support, but that has been reduced over time and probably will continue to do so. I mean, the quality of life of Venezuelan citizens who do not have access to dollars, in other words, the poor, is getting progressively worse. And in fact, the rate of poverty today is higher in Venezuela than when Hugo Chavez first came to power at the end of last century. That is a remarkable fact and statistic. And the quality of life, as I mentioned, gets worse. And in terms of things like the power blackouts, which have plagued the country now for days on end, the truth is that affects people without generators. Well, who doesn't have a generator? It's the poor. So these folks are in some bad straits, and you're starting to see the migratory patterns show that. People leaving the country are increasingly less well-off, less wealthy. In terms of the military, that clearly is part of the strategy of the international community to force change, is to try to have a sufficient number of military leaders to renounce the Maduro regime and express their loyalty to Juan Guaido. And that has been occurring, but as I mentioned, not in sufficient numbers for it to make a dramatic difference at this point. We don't know if this is going to shift overnight in terms of some sort of like a Romanian scenario that got rid of Ceausescu or others, or it will continue on indefinitely. This is one of the big questions that I think many, many people are watching right now in Venezuela.
To you, Kristen Tennyson, for your take.
Well, start with the military. I think that there are going to be issues that will make it difficult for some in the military to abandon their support of the Maduro administration. In particular, the idea that many of these individuals have been involved in what we would consider human rights abuses against the Venezuelan people. Many have been involved in corruption and graft on a very large scale, and even potentially drug trafficking and narco-trafficking through the region. And so the worry and fear in turning away from the Maduro administration is, well, then what happens to us in the legal process that ensues afterward? What type of transitional justice might exist, and what would it mean for us? And so that is something that, you know, as Eric said, might take more time for them to do the cost-benefit analysis. As far as the public, you know, many of the benefits that were given to the public as far as health care and subsidies went away a long time ago. But there is this strong sentiment that no other administration has really catered to or cared about that population in Venezuelan history. And so really with Chavez, it was the first time that they felt seen and heard and appreciated as part of the Venezuelan society. And so they also are a little bit hesitant to turn away from the ideology behind the Maduro administration and Chavismo, because who comes next, and will they abandon us? Will it go back to the way it was before? Will it be, you know, that large underclass and high rates of poverty, low rates of education, low rates of access to medical care? So there are those that might persistently continue to support the administration because they support the ideology behind it.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Carol Castiel. My guests are Eric Farnsworth. He's Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the America Society, and Kristen Tennyson, from whom you just heard. She's the chair of the Western Hemisphere Area Studies Division at the Foreign Service Institute. And we're discussing the political crisis in Venezuela, and will soon tackle U.S.-Brazilian relations. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout-out to a very loyal listener, Goodness Nwokolo from Yola, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us, and do leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, before we turn to Brazil, one more quick question, Eric, about Venezuela. You know, you talked about the humanitarian situation. Is any aid getting in, and who is providing that?
There are efforts to get aid into the country, which have largely been unsuccessful. And the reason why is because the Maduro regime, for its own ideological purposes, refuses to allow it in. In fact, on February 23rd, there was a real effort by the international community to push aid across the border from Colombia and from Brazil. And you saw the news reports and the photographs, and you saw aid trucks burning. And indeed, people were actually killed on the border with Brazil. And I think that that one episode, as unfortunate as it was, it did do something that was very important. It showed the world the true nature of the Maduro regime in Venezuela. That, to me, encapsulates what we're dealing with here in terms of the regime in Caracas. There is some aid, put that in quotes, that's coming in from Russia and China and perhaps a little bit from Cuba, but that's not humanitarian assistance as we would characterize it in the context of food and medicine and basic assistance for the most needy population.
And quickly, what's your view of the United States strategy? Does the United States, in your view, have a comprehensive plan for a peaceful transition? Are sanctions working? How do you see the U.S. strategy?
Well, the strategy seems to be based on the anaconda snakes that you might find in Venezuela, these very large snakes that kill their prey by slowly constricting. And that seems to be what the strategy is. You continue to ramp up pressure through sanctions, both bilateral and internationally coordinated, that put pressure on the regime to either change course and begin to restore democracy or, in fact, leave the scene altogether and allow a transition government to come into place and then call for elections that would, again, to restore the country. Having said that, it does seem to be things will be coming to a head shortly because the sanctions that were put in place recently, particularly on the energy sector, but also in the financial sector in Venezuela, mean that the regime will not have access to hard currency, at least from the Western world, very soon. And they're going to have to make some real tough decisions in terms of how to pay their security forces and others.
So, Kristen, anything to add or subtract with regard to the humanitarian situation and, of course, the U.S. strategy? To what extent is it working, not working?
I just want to add that there is a deep amount of concern for the plight of the Venezuelan people. So trying to sort of strangle the administration and thwart their efforts to remain in power does not mean that that's the aim for what's happening with the people in Venezuela. There are, you know, many who are deeply concerned about the lack of access to very basic medical care, the lack of access to food, the brownouts, the blackouts. And so that's why these attempts to get aid into the country are so important. And it is geographically difficult to get aid into Venezuela. I mean, topographically, it's difficult. So there are these choke points, and that also makes it difficult and allows the Maduro administration to be able to stop aid from coming in. But while trying to get the administration to leave or to transition, the U.S. government wants to make sure that the Venezuelan people are not suffering any more than they have to.
And I think that's a very important clarification in the context of what is the real aim here. It's not to punish the Venezuelan people. It's to try to cause the government to change its path.
So let's turn quickly before we close to U.S.-Brazilian relations, because newly elected President of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, chose Donald Trump as the first foreign head of state to visit. They are similar, one would say. Bolsonaro has been nicknamed the Trump of the tropics because of similar ideological views. He has a populist style. He uses Twitter. He lashes out at mainstream media, etc. It was like a bit of a love fest. So, Eric, what came of this meeting? Do you see this bilateral alliance changing, and in what way?
Well, I like the way you described it. It was a love fest, and both presidents said so, and clearly the body language indicated a real sense of comfort between the two presidents, and I think the hope is, at least in both governments, is that that personal relationship may begin to trickle down to the broader bilateral relationship institutionally so that both the United States and Brazil can really begin to address some of the issues that have been difficult for us over the last several years, for example, in trade and economics, security relationship, in working together on Venezuela, as you mentioned earlier, and working together on China, where the views of the United States and Brazil perhaps diverge somewhat. But the ability to have that type of a personal relationship, I think, it will have an impact in terms of driving a closer relationship between the United States and Brazil, and we'll have to see how long that lasts and on what basis and whether it's a sustainable relationship going forward.
Turning to you, Kristen Tennyson, President Trump said he intended to designate Brazil as a major non-NATO ally. He wants to expand trade, as Eric said. What else do you see coming out of this relationship for both the United States and Brazil?
I mean, it is the biggest economy in the region. And so, that is a relationship that will be important. It is an important bilateral relationship. I tend to think of this, though, about what's happening domestically in Brazil and what might overshadow the bilateral relationship. I mean, it's certainly important that we maintain very close ties with Brazil, but Bolsonaro has had a very rough transition in a rough few months. The real is continuing to slip, and he's trying to pass pension reform, and the legislative process on that is rather fraught internally. As much as there might be goodwill and a love fest between the leaders of both countries, domestic concerns might become more pressing. Certainly, as we internally, domestically kind of turn to our own election cycle, things might overshadow the bilateral relationship.
Well, that's an interesting point. And we also note that the ex-president of Brazil, Michel Temer, he was charged recently with heading a cartel who allegedly pocketed $500 million in a scheme involving construction contracts at a nuclear plant. This is part of this so-called Lava Jato. So that's one thing. But there's also what Kristen said, Eric Farnsworth, about how Bolsonaro is doing so far with respect to tackling corruption, which he said he would do, crime, the reformation of the pension system.
Yeah, he's got some big issues in front of him that he really has to address. And even though he's only been in office since January 1st of this year, still some people are beginning to get a little bit impatient in terms of the progress that has or hasn't been made. He was elected, some people would say, really to address the whole corruption issue that Brazil has faced for some time. And the fact that he was not a member of the Workers' Party or the PT, which came before him, and you know, if you talk to Brazilian voters, many will say they voted against the PT rather than for the particular president, Jair Bolsonaro. So you do have a question of mandate in terms of what is he actually been elected to get done. But clearly corruption issues are at the forefront. And to the extent that these continue to be in the news in such a dramatic way, that reminds people of the very difficult work that needs to be done. But I think it's also instructive to look at the stock market, which has been bid up a lot over the course of the first part of this year on the anticipation that some of these dramatic reforms are going to occur. And now over the last few days, you've seen a regression of that because of some of the political issues I think that Kristen has been mentioning and talking about. So there are probably no easy wins here. This is going to be a difficult road. And to the extent that the president is perceived as somewhat controversial or says things or tweets things that do not make building coalitions in Congress any easier, that's going to make the economic reform program even that much more difficult to achieve.
And back to you, Kristen, for the last word. Anything to add or subtract? And also, what does the United States expect of Brazil in return for some of these preferential arrangements that were promised, whether with respect to the non-NATO ally designation or joining perhaps the OECD?
Well, with regard to what's happening domestically, I mean, it's been a very short period of time since Bolsonaro came into office, but the honeymoon has been brief. He's already down 16 points in favorability in the polls, still with roughly half the population supporting him. But that kind of speaks to Eric's point that it was a vote against what came, the Labor Party, and not necessarily a vote for Bolsonaro. I think that the United States wants a really strong ally in the Southern Hemisphere and wants a like-minded policy ally in the hemisphere, wants to have a strategy to sort of combat, you know, some of the administrations that have been antagonistic towards the United States, but also a strong economic partner, which Brazil offers, you know, can offer, has the potential to offer. But again, well, it remains to be seen. It's so new, the administration. It's marked by what people call chaos and infighting and intrigue, all the very fun things of politics. So there's a bit of a question mark that hangs over all of it still.
Well, the question mark hangs over Venezuela, unfortunately, but we will be following the story, and we'd love to have you both back to discuss both countries and the continent. I'm afraid on that note, that's all the time we have on this Latin American edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Eric Farnsworth, he's Vice President of the America Society and Council of the Americas, and Kristen Tennyson, Chair of the Western Hemisphere Area Studies Division at the Foreign Service Institute. Thank you. Gracias. Obrigada for coming in and for sharing your keen insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rob McLean. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.